So far, 2018 has been a pretty amazing year for new shows in London, and today's guest is currently starring in one of them, The Grinning Man at Trafalgar Studios. It's Mark Anderson. Hello, Mark.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Good. How's the show going?
Yeah, it's going really well. We opened in December, and I'm really, really having a great time, actually. And everyone that comes to see it, seems to be having a really nice time, too. So that's good. And I think it's really good, and it's really different, and I think it's exactly what the West End needs at the moment.
Uh-huh. So for those people who haven't seen it yet, what's the basic premise? What's the story? Because it's loosely based on, you've said, on Hugo's novel, which is called...
Yeah, The Man Who Laughs.
The Man Who Laughs.
And I would say it is quite loosely based.
Mm-hmm.
But in a nutshell, the main thread of it is that there's a young lad who has his mouth slit.
Uh-huh.
And the play is about the mystery of who did that to him. Mm-hmm. And it's about him coming back to London, mm-hmm. or London, as we call it in the
London.
Show.
London, yeah.
And coming back to London to sort of find the man who did it to him,
uh-huh.
and also to avenge his father's death.
Okay. For those people who don't know, it did start its life in Bristol.
It did.
At the Old Vic in Bristol. It did a short run there, it must have been a year and a half ago or something like that.
Yeah, something like that.
And then it's obviously transferred into London for this run in the West End. How different is this version of the show to the one that was in Bristol? Did you get to recreate much?
Yeah, well, apparently it's very different, mm-hmm. to what they did in Bristol. Even as far as the writing goes, they changed a lot of it. One of the main things as a cast member is that in Bristol there were only 9 in the company, in the cast. And now there's 16 of us.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, so everyone in Bristol played everything.
Uh-huh.
They would run into the wing, quick change and come back on as something else. And there's still a lot of that, I would, mm-hmm. say, in our version. But they really did it like that in Bristol. From what I've heard, because I never saw it in Bristol, they've condensed it a lot and sort of really punched out that main storyline.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Mm. And I guess if you're not running into the wings and changing into another character, you get to hold on to your character more firmly, so
yes,
so you can
exactly
more fully realise that performance,
mm.
Which must be quite nice. So remind me what your character's name was, because I've forgotten now.
He's called Deary Moir.
I saw it last night and I've forgotten. That's really
Lord
embarrassing.
David Deary Moir.
And I mean, it's a great character to play. It's kind of one of those, if I was still performing, it's one of those characters that I would have absolutely been seething with jealousy because you were playing it and I wasn't.
Mm.
It's a fantastic... What are you laughing at? It's a fantastic role. Can you kind of sum him up?
Yeah. He's really innocent, I want to say, but he has a dark side, and I think that's true with all of the royal family. He's, mm-hmm. he's a prince. And they are all so bored, and they're just looking for that next thing that's going to make them happy.
Mm. Were you aware, because it seemed to me when I was watching it last night, that there's obviously so many political statements in, certainly as far as the aristocracy in your show is concerned, and those characters and how they kind of look down on the less fortunate. There's so many of those political references, and it feels like the writers and you as the company are making statements as well. That must have been something that came up quite a lot in rehearsals.
Yeah, it did, especially with, you know, the climate we're in.
Uh-huh.
You can't avoid it at the moment. It really is at the forefront of everyone's mind.
Mm.
And even something that isn't, you know, it's literally straight from the novel, say, is still relevant.
Yeah.
And people are thinking that, oh, they've made that about today.
Uh-huh. Yeah, but it's actually something
it's really not.
Yeah. That happens a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That happens a lot. And I guess with great writers like Victor Hugo, who wrote the original novel, that's what makes them great writers, is because they're picking up on points that are timeless and that kind of travel through generations. And I was really encouraged last night because, as I said at the beginning of this episode, I feel like there is a real new wave of exciting theatre happening at the moment. For a long time, it felt like it was the same old kind of shows, and most of them based on existing movies or existing catalogues of songs. But it feels like we're in a new wave of things, exciting things happening. The Grinning Man, everyone's talking about Jamie, The Ferryman, Girl from the North Country. It feels like really exciting work is happening, and I'm so happy to be in London to see it all. And last night, the theatre was full.
Yeah. No, I've been saying this for the past couple of months, actually. Everywhere you look now in London is something new, and it's from, and you know, it's from, it's not from a film, which is what we've come accustomed to. And also what we've come accustomed to is there are, you know, there's somebody usually famous in it. I'm going to say stunt casting.
Yeah.
But if you look around the West End, there isn't any. Hamilton's none, Jamie none, you know, and it's all just talented people getting the work because they're talented and they've trained, you know, and they're skilled.
Which proves a point, doesn't it?
That, totally
that,
does,
that it can survive without someone from Hollyoaks or someone from EastEnders.
And like you say, they're all unknown titles as well. So, I mean...
Do you think, though, I mean, I don't want to talk about the recession in a very general way, but do you think that... You know, we have just essentially come out of a recession, I guess, you know, in the last kind of 2 years. Do you think that the time in London where it was just jukebox musicals, musicals that were based on films like, you know, Shrek and plays that were based on films that we knew, do you think that was a reaction to producers not wanting to take risks because it was a difficult time, you know, so they just thought, let's just put something on, safe bet, and we know it's going to make money.
I think that's definitely true, yeah. Yeah, and I think it's probably had a tiny damaging effect on our industry because now people are too scared to take risks because they've felt the wealth from putting on the titles that we all know.
Yeah, and I feel there was a bit of a... Not to get too bleak about it, but I feel there was a bit of a... it was quite... miserable in a sense, because I feel like people in the business, in the industry, acting industry, were very aware of what was going on, and at times it was quite uninspiring, wasn't it, to be a part of, knowing that producers weren't taking risks and knowing that those that lead role was going to go to a TV actress instead of a theatre actor, things like that. It was quite a bleak few years, I think.
Yeah, it was. But do you know what? I really liked some of them, and I thought... The skill that went into some of them was equally as impressive as new writing. I think one of the best ones is Jersey Boys. I really like Jersey Boys. But then it was more biographical. It wasn't trying to thread a storyline through some songs that really exist.
Yeah, because it can be done well. It can really
definitely
be done well, yeah. But I never saw Jersey Boys, but which is really bad because it was on for 10 years. I should be ashamed of myself. But everyone said the same thing, which was... That was a real, real effort to make this collection of songs into something really, really fantastic.
That's right. But producers saw that and then made some sort of, you know, half-assed attempt at somebody else's back catalogue.
Yeah.
And they didn't quite work. But people thought, oh, I know their songs. I'm going to go see it.
Yeah. Well, you're appealing to not theatregoers, but you're appealing to fans of ABBA or fans of Queen.
And the work became secondary.
The stories and the characters became secondary to let's get this song into the show.
Definitely.
But it is, I do feel like we're on this massive turning point, and it's so exciting. You know, as days go on in 2018, new work is getting announced every day, and it's so exciting. I feel like we're in a really, really exciting place. And, you know, maybe there's some synergy with what's happening politically, but I feel like you have to go back to kind of go forward. Sometimes you have to kind of reassess where you are and gather yourself. And that's a moment that we've just been through. And now we're going, actually, okay, let's move forward and let's get on with some new work, some really exciting work. Like today, for example, Flowers for Mrs. Harris was announced that's going to go to Chichester, which I'm really excited about because it's by probably one of my favourite British composers at the moment, Richard Taylor. And, you know, it's so exciting to see his work being celebrated. It's it just feels like a good time.
Yeah, it is. And it's good that these big producers are taking the risks because we need them to set example.
And The Grinning Man is definitely... part of that new wave. Now, you're quite passionate about new writing? I know that you get involved in it when you can as an actor, and also you write yourself as well.
I do, yeah. I'm trying. It's not a new thing for me, but I would consider myself, like, because I've never had anything put on, do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
But I've written, for the past 2 years, I've written the opening number for West End Bears,
mm-hmm,
with my friend Luke De Soma, which I've absolutely loved. And that was sort of being in the right place at the right time.
So for those people who don't know, what is West End Bears?
Oh, West End Bears is an annual charity event, mm-hmm, all for Theatre Mad, which is the Make a Difference Trust. And basically, theatre industry people
strip
from the West End and beyond, get their clothes off for money. Which sounds more seedy than it actually is. And it's actually a big production, and lots of choreographers get involved, and everyone gives up their free time. And,
yeah, it is a pretty amazing event. You're right. From the outside, it could seem a bit seedy, but it was created, I think, in America, wasn't
in
it?
In Americas, yeah.
Jerry Mitchell, who obviously founded Broadway Bears, and it was his kind of baby. For those people who don't know, Jerry Mitchell directed Kinky Boots. He also directed Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Legally
and
Blonde.
Choreographed Legally Blonde. Did he direct that as well?
Yeah.
Did he? Wow. Yeah. He's good, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's quite good.
And directed, choreographed Kinky Boots.
Yeah, I think
he's all right,
that.
Isn't he?
Yeah, he's doing well. He's doing all right for himself. But he founded it on Broadway and then it came over here.
And then, yeah, I think Darren Cornell brought it here.
Right.
And now it's run by David Grucock and Darren Lee Murphy.
Mm.
And it's got bigger and bigger as well.
Yeah,
every single
it has.
It's so good.
Yeah, yeah. I need to go. Do I need to go and see it? Probably not. I think I can deal with like the social media
fallout. Do you want
fallout.
To go and see it?
Not really, no. Not really. But you write the opening number for that.
Done that for the past 2 years, and we've been asked to do it again this year.
Amazing.
Yeah.
When is it again? What time of year?
It's autumn time.
So if people want to go and see West End actors with the clothes off, autumn, West End Bears, look it up.
Yeah.
You'll have a lovely time. And you'll also hear some of your writing. You also did... you workshopped one of your musicals as well, which I saw at the Other Palace,
yeah.
Called Dinah Story, which was... Well, tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I love dinosaurs, basically. I have done since I was a kid. I think lots of little children do, actually. And about 9 years ago, I had this idea for a song that I just wanted to write. And it was called A Rose Between Three Horns. And it was about a triceratops finding love.
Mm-hmm. I love it already. I'm hooked.
And I wrote the lyrics to it in about half an hour. And since then, I've asked, you know, I've been to a few composers, because I don't write music, I just write lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
I've been to a few composers, and I eventually found one. You know, I've not like kept on it for 9 years, but I keep picking it up. And I just think it's such a great idea that no one's tapped into yet, dinosaurs in a musical.
To be fair, there are some reasons why they may not have done that, but yeah.
And I found this guy called Luke De Soma, who I write the West End Bears stuff with, and he was really keen, really wanted to do it.
But there's quite an interesting slant on it as well, isn't it, the story? Because you're a vegan.
Yeah.
And, we could do our own, like, 30-minute episode about that, because I don't understand. No, I do. And you've kind of, like, stranded that conversation into this idea of herbivores versus meat eaters. And it's actually quite a good concept. It's actually really sweet.
Yeah. Do you know what? The where that came from was, like I said, I wrote that song and it was about her falling in love.
Mm.
That song isn't in it anymore.
Mm.
Because what I was seeing more and more in the West End and wherever is that female characters were so underwritten.
Uh-huh.
And there was one show, I won't say the name, but there was a girl just writing in her diary about finding love. And I thought, why in 2016, 17 is there a female protagonist just wanting to find the perfect man?
Right.
And I thought...
Like they can't aspire for more.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I wanted to make Rose, the Triceratops, in my story about something else.
Uh-huh.
So she sets out to carry on the Festival of Foliage, which her mum started way back. And that's a time of year. Sorry, I'm talking about this so seriously. Every year in our world, it's the Festival of Foliage, and it happens for a week every single year where all the carnivores take an oath not to eat meat. And for that week alone, they all get on.
Mm-hmm.
It's really beautiful.
It is actually, I mean, it's clearly aimed towards a family audience,
yeah.
And children, and it carries a message, doesn't it? You're trying to get a point across in a quite an innocent way and in a fun way. But obviously, it then has that kind of aftertaste for the parents who've taken the kids along about, you know, vegetarian, giving up meat, veganism, things like that. I thought it was really sweet. And we saw a workshop production of it, which was part of a kind of week or a festival, wasn't it, of new writing at the other palace. And where is it now? What's going on with it? Do you want to take it forward, or are you happy to kind of leave it where it is?
Talking about the sort of female intervention, when I decided I wanted Rose to be more than just someone who falls in love, I really, really wanted to get a female voice in the creative team.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked my friend Erin Carter, who I knew from some performing stuff, who's also a phenomenal writer, and she's now writing the book for us.
Great. Did you have a book writer on board?
No, we didn't.
Right.
Yeah.
And I imagine that that's quite a turning point, isn't it, getting a book writer?
Yeah, it is. And I was just, you know, fumbling some stuff together just to get us into that festival to start with. And when we got accepted, I thought, I don't want to do that.
Mm.
I want a female voice.
I feel like book writers are the unsung heroes of...
Definitely.
...of musicals.
And the thing is, if a musical works, people praise the music and the lyrics and the songs.
Yeah.
If a music doesn't work, everyone says the book's
faulty. Yeah. It's so true. I think that, you know, you look at someone like Arthur Lawrence, who wrote the book for Gypsy and West Side Story, you know, someone like that, just really, really fantastic book writing.
Yeah.
And it is the linchpin of the entire production.
Totally
You've
is,
got
yeah.
to have a good book. But
yeah. And that's where the songs come from.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Mm.
So now where we're at with the show is that Luke, who is a Kiwi, which is a New Zealand person.
Oh, right. Okay,
not being rude. He is away and he's been there all summer. So as soon as he gets back, we're going to start it up again. I think we need a sort of break, step away from it for a few months to sort of see what we've done and what we need to do.
Mm. And you're really good friends with quite a successful lyricist.
Yeah.
Anthony Drew of Styles and Drew fame.
Never heard of him.
And for those people who don't know, I can't imagine why you would be listening to this if you don't know, but Styles and Drew have written Mary Poppins, they wrote the new songs for Half a Sixpence, Honk, Betty Blue Eyes... Wind in the Willows.
I've said half a sixpence.
So they're quite good. They're doing all right.
Yeah. They
And would you say he's? I mean, he's obviously a friend, but is he a mentor in terms of the lyric writing?
Yeah, definitely. If I'm unsure of something, I'll say, had this idea, but I can't get it across, or I'll send him a line of a lyric, and I'll say, I want this to make sense, but I can't. I wrote a whole song for the dinosaur show with Luke, and it was called This Place. And it started off saying, here, da 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 da, in this place. And Anthony heard it because I asked him for some feedback, and he said, I don't know if it's called here or if it's called this place. It sort of had two hooks.
Right.
So that, I mean, always
just
stuff
that
like
kind
that.
Of advice, yeah.
And early on, when I first started, he taught me a lot about meter and syllable structure and rhyme. And he's really hot on true rhymes. And, you know, as all his phenomenal predecessors, Sondheim, you won't hear do a false rhyme.
Yeah.
So Hammerstein, like you won't hear do a false
jamming
rhyme.
Jamming making words rhyme when they don't really.
Yeah, even stuff like love rhyming with of, it doesn't.
Right, yeah.
But there's the most common one, probably.
Uh-huh.
And nowadays, that is changing. And, you know, I don't judge a musical for it.
Mm-hmm.
but I think there's less skill to it.
To lyricists now, you think it's...
To false rhyming than there is to obviously
right.
true.
Yeah. What an amazing connection to have for an aspiring writer. Mm. What an amazing person to be in touch with.
Yeah, and they are fundamental in new writing in London.
George and Anthony.
Yeah, they are part of the MMD, which is Mercury Musical Developments. Mm. Every year they have the Styles and Drew Prize, which is part of it is a song prize for best song. And the other one is the mentorship scheme, which they take a whole musical and over the course of a year have workshops and labs. Mm. And at the end of it, they present it. And the Wicker Husband came from that 2 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And they've just had the other one, and that's going to do a presentation later this year.
Yeah, they are. So they really get their hands in, don't they, in terms of that. And it's quite nice because I don't know their history very well, but I feel like that's how they started, wasn't it? It was someone taking a chance on them.
Yeah, well, the story goes that they won the Vivian Ellis Prize and Cameron McIntosh was on the panel, and they entered Just So into that. And Cameron, at the end, said, congratulations, what are you going to do with it now? And George apparently turned to him and said, no, what are you going to do with it now? And that's how their relationship blossomed.
That's
incredible. Cameron ended up producing Just So. And that's, you know, that's when they got on board with Mary Poppins and, you know, the rest is literally history.
Amazing. That is really, really incredible. And of course, your association with Styles and Drew doesn't just end at them kind of mentoring your creative side, but you've been in quite a few of their shows.
Yeah. My first job out of school was Honk at the Watermill in Newbury. And it was sort of like an actor muso version with Sarah Travis did all the arrangements and Stephen Dexter directed. Sam Spencer Lane, our mutual friend, choreographed.
Who did you play? Ugly.
I played Ugly. Right. Yeah. But it was phenomenal to me that the writing team, Styles and Drew, were in our rehearsal room.
Were they big then? Did people know who they were?
Yeah, they'd won the Olivier for it already.
For Honk
in 2000. They beat Lion King and Mamma Mia to the Olivier in 2000.
That's mental.
And we did this in 2007. And there's a lady called Jill Fraser who used to run the Watermill. And she sort of commissioned them to write Honk. And it all started life at the Watermill.
Yeah.
And so they were doing like a 10-year anniversary, and it was all the same creative team as before, and it was a big deal. So they came in a lot, and they were... And even now, you know, talking to Ants, he'll be like, oh, I'm going to Belgium this weekend because there's an amateur group doing Peter Pan.
I noticed that about them. They're so interested in people doing their work and supportive. It's amazing, isn't it?
And I think they know how much it means because they've been there.
Uh-huh.
To have someone like that go over.
Yeah.
It's really, really sweet.
Yeah. So tell me a bit about Honk then. Was that your first thing
I did a job in Australia as soon as I graduated. And then I came back, and over the Christmas, just after I graduated, we did Honk.
And Ugly's, the Watermill, for people who don't know it, is a really respected, really exciting space. Yeah. Ugly's essentially the lead.
Yeah.
That's a fantastic kind of first job, really,
isn't it? Yeah, it really was. I couldn't believe my luck, to be honest. And I didn't appreciate it at the time.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what I mean? Because you graduate and you think, I've got this.
Yeah.
And you get offered a great job and it's fantastic, and then you don't work.
Yeah.
But luckily, after Honk, I already had Mary Poppins lined up.
Your second Styles and Drew show.
Second Styles and Drew show. Like I said, I went to Australia with a show just after I graduated. I'd auditioned for all of these things previous to that.
So you had them lined up?
So I had them lined up. And I actually got a call about Mary Poppins when I was in Sydney. And I finished Honk, and then I had a little gap of a couple of months, and then I started Mary Poppins. But I didn't know George and Ants then.
Uh-huh.
So I got Honk, and then apparently Trevor Jackson, who cast Mary Poppins for Cameron, he said to George and Ants, I think you're going to like our Roberts and I, which is the character I played in Mary Poppins, because you've just cast him in Honk.
Right.
So... Amazing. It just sort of fell into place. And
so, there's so much to say about the collection of information that you've just offered up, because first of all, that just doesn't happen to a new grad coming out of drama school. That does not happen. You do not book three jobs in a row, especially one of them being, because it was the first UK tour of Mary Poppins
as well,
and they were all parts.
Yeah.
You know, because a lot of people do start in the ensemble and they have to work their way up.
Yeah.
That's amazing. So first of all, well done, Mark.
Thanks.
And secondly, I'd like to talk about Mary Poppins in a bit, but was there a time where you then had to relearn what it was to be an actor in work, in terms of there are dry spells and there are times when you know, you're not booking job after job after job?
Yes.
And was that a difficult process for you?
It wasn't difficult because I always knew the reality of it. And yeah, I probably got a bit cocky as soon as I graduated. And I think that was also partly to do with that I went to Guildford, I went to GSA, and I auditioned for musical theatre. And because at home I did all the amateur stuff, you know, and I was always in the musicals and I loved it. But when I auditioned for drama school, I only got into Guildford and I only got onto the acting course.
Right.
So it really, really knocked my confidence a lot.
You did the acting course?
I started on the acting course.
I did not know this about you.
And then in the second year, I said, please, can I go on to the musical theatre course? But by then, you know, everyone had already had a year and there were phenomenal singers and people were amazing at dancing. And I was just a bit daft.
But quirky.
But they let me. And I was never a favourite. I never got into the extracurricular stuff. And I did showcase and I got such amazing interest off agents that I think people were a bit shocked.
Mm.
But I think I just chose a really good piece that I knew showed me off.
I don't think it's just that. I mean, you're very talented, Mark, first and foremost, but also... Can I say this? I know I'm saying this with love, but you have a quirk about you that no one else can do. You're bringing something to the table that other people, even if they try, they can't do what you do, because you're different in the best possible way. And I think that's what's kind of led to these roles that you get and this career that you've had. Because it is, I mean, it's a really lovely career that you've had, and I've watched it, you know, as a friend since Mary Poppins,
But going back to, you know, the times of work, being out of work. After Mary Poppins, I did Hello Dolly at Regent's Park, and then I didn't work.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
And I didn't work for about 2 years apart from Panto.
I remember that.
And a few workshops. And having just graduated and got four jobs and really good ones and then don't work for 2 years... I was really, I was a bit like, oh, okay. But also, I don't mind working in a bar. I really don't mind working in a bar, because at the end of the day, I have to pay the rent.
Mm. But you did go through, because I remember you did go through a little stage where you weren't happy about it. I seem to remember us having some conversations where you were kind of saying, I'm finding this really, really difficult. How do you keep positive, interested, and how do you keep going to those auditions when you're not booking the work?
It's really, really hard, because what people don't realise is that auditioning is a full-time job.
Correct.
When you're not in acting work.
Mm.
And it's the hardest bit and you're not getting paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to work at nighttime so that you're free in the day. To do auditions, and you're prepping material for weeks, and then you get in the room and they don't even hear it. And it's really disheartening. My old agent said something great to me one time, and I got offered this role at the Tabard Theatre over Christmas one year, and he said, you don't have to audition, but this director wants you to do this. He saw you in this and he worked with you on this. And I said, that's amazing. And it was very little money. And I said, yeah, but I'm going to earn more doing this reception job I'm doing at the minute. And my agent said, yes, Mark, but you are an actor. You are not a receptionist.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And that is literally one of the best things I've ever heard, because worked so hard to train for 3 years to be actors.
Mm.
And just that, I sort of got carried away with, this is hard to put into words, but I lost the love a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Which I think is, I don't think you're on your own. I think a lot of people do go through that stage.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people, because the reality of being an actor is quite different, I think, from the fantasy of being an actor.
Mm.
I teach a lot, as you know, and I say to students all the time, being an actor, the job of being an actor, is probably 35% of it is what you do on stage.
Yeah.
But the other huge chunk of your kind of career is that being out of work, going to auditions, preparing mm-hmm. material, networking, making sure you're keeping yourself fit and healthy and
yeah.
ready. And it is when the reality of that sinks in, there is a bit of a process that you have to go through and go, oh, okay, this is what it's going to be like.
Yeah. But, you know, I try and see as much theatre as possible and I just keep inspired that way, I think, because I
do see a lot of theatre. You're much better than I am.
But I love what I do.
Mm-hmm.
I really, really love it. And I love seeing other people loving what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I love watching people make incredible stuff. And I dream of making that myself, you know, one day. And I'd love to earn money from writing one day.
Mm.
And I think that's how I keep going when I'm out of work.
Yeah. You've almost kind of proven to yourself or quietened that voice in your head that says, I'm not good enough. Because now you've done these amazing shows. You know, you've done, as you said, Hello Dolly at Regent's Park. You've done Mary Poppins. You were in Book of Mormon in the West End for 2 years. There must be something in your head that's going, okay, I know I'm good enough. So it's not that. It's just that the right job hasn't come along. So it's more relaxed now.
I think that comes with age as well and experience.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas 6 years ago, I wouldn't get a recall and I'd think, my God, what have I done? I now come out and think, cool, the guy next to me had brown hair.
Yeah. It was just, circumstantial, just something, yeah.
Or even I will wake up on the day and think, oh, my voice isn't quite there today. I'm just going to go in and do the best that I can do today.
Yeah. Do you ever get worried about that? Singing on an off day in front of these people. Do you ever get worried? Because I guess if you were in a show, you'd just cancel. You wouldn't go into work that night. Although sometimes, as you know more than anyone, that isn't that easy. But do you ever get worried about going in auditions and letting casting directors, directors, musical directors see you on an off day? Is that a concern for an actor?
Yeah, it is. Of course, it is. Because you know, sometimes you know you can do much better than. But there's so many factors. And this is what I mean that you learn from experience. It's nerves. It's even what the weather's doing that day.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
It's whether you nearly got run down on the way there with a coffee in your hand and your music in the other hand. It's all of those things.
Yeah.
And I know the minute one foot goes into that room how the audition is going to go.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I always say that. Because you can tell there's a vibe in the room.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes it's not your fault.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that panel are just not having it.
And is that easier to let go now as well with age? Yeah. I imagine that it would be. I can't imagine going back into acting, but if I did, I imagine that I'd have come to that realisation by now that actually, do you know what, Kirk, it's not about you.
It's really not. And they've just seen the part that you're up for and they've seen someone good enough and they're going to cast him.
Yeah.
And now they have to see you because you're already on the call sheet.
So I just want to kind of come full circle, I guess, and to the last couple of years of the jobs that you've been doing. And something that I really, really loved seeing you in and I know was a really big part of your life for kind of a year was Toxic Avenger, which you played the title role when it opened at Southwark. And then a few months later, it went to Edinburgh and then eventually wound up at the Arts Theatre in the West End. Talk to me a little bit about that experience because because I came to see it, I thought that original production in Southwark, I didn't see it in Edinburgh, but that production was just one of the best things I've probably seen in that space. And the thing I loved about it was that there was only five of you in the show, but you were all singing from the same hymn sheet. You knew exactly what the tone is. And as a creative and as an artistic person, there was such joy in that, that you were all, you knew exactly what the tone was. I loved watching that.
The thing with it is, like you said, everyone in that room was on the same page. And I think that the director, Benji, was great, and he also cast it very well with people that also he knew would get on with each other. And just we all wanted that show to work. And I don't want to sound weird, but it was magic. It was like magic in the room.
No, it felt like it from the audience's point of view. As I say, it's such a rare thing when you can, you just know that everyone's working together. It was, it was like cogs. You're all kind of turning at the same pace.
And it's that great thing with a new show. Even it'd been done in America, but we have different, you know, sensibilities here. We didn't know how it was going to go. Really didn't know how it was going to go, because it was pastiche. It was sort of the same vein as Mormon.
Yeah, well, it was just, as I've said, and I'll say it again because I don't care. It was one of the best nights of theatre I've seen at Southwark.
It's one of my favourite jobs.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. So when it came up again to go to the Fringe Festival, it was a few months later, you obviously said yes and you went back.
Yeah.
But that was a bit of a different experience for you, wasn't it? Because doing it in terms of eight shows a week, a normal show schedule is one thing, but the Fringe is a different cup of tea, isn't it? In terms of it's quite...
The Fringe is really hard.
Intense.
Yeah, and I'd always wanted to go and I'd always wanted to perform there. So for me, it was a no-brainer that I wanted to do it. But firstly, I was the only one that stayed out of the cast from Southwark Playhouse. So we had four brand new, incredible people come in. And it was so nice to do the show from a different point of view. And I say that I'm lucky because the first cast in Southwark, I took everything that they gave me from there. And then when this new cast came in, I already had all of that wealth. And I still took from them,
the
new people. So I was really fortunate. And we went to Edinburgh and it was hard. It was really hard.
The schedule,
yeah, it was... We started at 10 o'clock at night.
Wow.
And they condensed it, obviously, because it's the Fringe Festival, but Toxic Avenger wasn't that long anyway. So I think they took about half an hour off it. And we did it all in one act, about an hour and 20 minutes. And as is, you know, custom with the festival, the show before you has to get out of the theatre and you have 15 minutes to get all your set in and, you know, get into your costumes and do a warm-up and everything else. And it just really didn't agree with me.
And so as a result, it started to take its toll on you a little
bit. Yeah, and there were some problems with costuming and, like I said, we were heavily compromised by the set and how that affected us because we didn't have time to get everything in and et cetera, et cetera. And it was massively stressful and there was a lot of PR and I ended up getting really sick, like very, very sick. And I ended up having to take the last two shows off. It got to the point where I couldn't sing.
It's funny, isn't it? Because in a normal environment for an actor, that would be kind of, that's fine. Take time off. You know, that would, the thing we always kind of say to each other as a community is you're not a machine. If you're ill, you're ill. Go home, get ready, you know, get better. And your understudy will go on. But of course, in Edinburgh, in the Fringe Festival, that's not a thing. And so it's difficult, isn't it? You feel that pressure about going off.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, we had understudies that we rehearsed with, but they weren't going to join us until we transferred to the West End. So we did know that somewhere in London that there was...
It was someone who knew it.
And we could get him up. But you just don't want to do that. And I had 2 days left, but like I said, I got to the point where I was singing and I saw people in the audience talking about it, talking about, oh, his voice isn't, you know, his voice sounds a bit tired or whatever. And I was really embarrassed and I had to say, enough is enough. And it's easy, you know, if you work in an office or if you're, you know, a policeman or whatever, you lose your voice, you're fine. You can still probably go to work. Mm-hmm. But when your voice is
the job,
yeah. you know, you get a slightest tickle and you think, I have to go off.
Uh-huh.
Because if I stay on and persist, it's just going to get worse and I'm going to need more time off.
Well, it's the same as a footballer. You know, if they have they pulled a muscle, they need time off to recover and then they can go back and play at their best. And it's the same for singers. And I think something I've always found really interesting is because it's art and because it's seen as quite a... You're very lucky to be in this job and it's not real work. People... don't think of it in the same way. They don't give sickness or illness or voice problems the same weight as perhaps you would do if this person was a footballer or an athlete.
Yeah.
But it's the same thing.
It is. And I saw an ENT doctor when I got back and he said something really good to me, picking up on that analogy you've just used. He said, if a footballer broke his ankle, he would be off for months and he would need to rehabilitate it during that time and he wouldn't get on the field again for months. Mm. But with a singer, you're because people don't think it's real, they don't think of it as an injury.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They expect you to get back on the next day.
And also, very often, even if you've got voice problems, you can still speak and your voice kind of sounds okay.
Yeah.
But the difference between singing and speaking is quite big.
Yeah. Well, my speech therapist encouraged me to talk normally, but just not sing.
Mm-hmm. Because it's a different thing. It's like lifting a can of Coke or lifting a weight in the gym. It's two completely different things and one's fine and one's not.
Yeah.
But I know that was a really difficult time for you and it must have been so frustrating not to finish Edinburgh. Mm. And then, of course, the show came to London as well. And do you feel, kind of knowing the trajectory of what then happened, do you feel like there was a set of events which started in Edinburgh that then kind of led to a natural conclusion in London?
Yeah, I mean, it never cleared up from Edinburgh.
Mm-hmm.
It never cleared up. And coming into London, I know, like I said before, I loved this job.
Mm-hmm.
It was my big break almost. I was playing a leading man in the West End, singing songs, which I loved, and I loved the show.
Mm-hmm.
It's exactly the type of theatre I love performing in.
Mm.
And I loved the company and I just loved going to work, really did. But it got really serious.
Mm-hmm. That must have been scary.
Yeah, it is. And for a singer, I'll say I got nodules. I got soft nodules.
Wow.
Because, I think it stemmed from Edinburgh and when we got to London, it was like straight back into it. And I never got that time to recover.
Mm.
And as much as I was willing to do the show, I would do two shows and have to have time off.
That's so frustrating. And that's so
working.
That must have been so heartbreaking.
Yeah.
I'm good friends with a lot of singers and I've worked with singers with really bad vocal problems and I know how heartbreaking that is. And that must have been really, really difficult.
I mean, I cried my eyes out when they told me I had soft nodules.
Mm, I can imagine.
Yeah.
Because it's the equivalent of a concert pianist breaking their finger.
Yeah.
You know, or it's completely career threatening.
Yeah. And luckily mine was totally reversible, but I just needed time off.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I had to make the decision to leave the show.
To leave the show in London.
Mm.
Yeah. And that... you know, having created the part all those months back in Southwark and then going to Edinburgh with it and coming back home with it to London in the West End, That must have been really difficult to walk away from.
Oh, yeah, it was. I really didn't want to leave that job. Mm. I had no gain from leaving that job. And I really wanted people to see me in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course.
Because like I said, could have been my big break.
Mm-hmm.
That's could stupid, have been. Isn't it?
No, I don't think it is stupid. I think you did the right thing. We spoke during the time, and we met for a silent coffee. Mm. I seem to remember you weren't speaking at the time. But I think ultimately it comes down to one of those things, doesn't it? And as I said, I repeat this because I mean it. I have friends who have had really bad vocal issues and have actually had to walk away from the business as a result.
And that's why it didn't want to happen to me.
Correct. This industry is a marathon, not a race. Mm. And you've got to play the long game. And sometimes that means making really tough decisions. And I think that's one of them that you've had to make. But you took some time out. You recovered. Your voice is back, strong, healthy. Yeah. And you're back in London, back on the stage. So it's kind of had the desired outcome, really. It ended up being the right thing for you, I think.
Yeah, it totally did.
It's tough at the time.
Luckily, I was surrounded by supportive people, especially at the Grinning Man, which I did pretty much straight away afterwards, who, you know, were so supportive and so understanding, said that I wasn't allowed to sing even in rehearsals, because people understand, but at the same time, they still wanted me to do it. Mm. So they helped me and they made it work. And I'm so grateful for that.
Well, it looks like a very supportive group of people from what I saw last night. You know, you kind of look really, really, again, a little bit like Toxic Avenger, a group of people working really, really well together.
Yeah.
And it's a fantastic show. If anyone can get down to see it, it's so worth seeing it. Now, Mark, if people want to follow you on social media, where can they find you?
They can find me on Twitter.
Okay.
At Marky W. Anderson.
Uh-huh. And do you allow people into your Facebook fold?
Absolutely not.
That's just for friends only.
I'm on Instagram.
Are you?
Same handle.
Really?
Yeah.
I've struggled with Instagram. It's not for me.
Really?
Do you take pictures of your vegan lunch and post them?
Sometimes.
Yeah, I thought you might.
No, I don't actually, but if I bake, then I will do that.
That's fair.
That's all right, isn't
it? That's fair. Well, Mark, thanks so much for talking to us today, and have a great time in the rest of the run of The Grinning Man.
Thanks.
Bye.
Pleasure.